In this fine hour, I know that we are all possessed with a great emotion, and that is gratitude for the wholesale miracle that has befallen the children of the night. We of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And our compelling thought in these happy days just past has been, how best can we serve the ends of this society? In gratitude, we praise God, whose grace has made this thing possible. And immediately, we think of the great number of people and circumstances who have formed this fellowship, who have composed this happy conspiracy. We think of our friends of medicine. We think of our friends of religion. For, as you must know, AA is something like a farmer's three-legged millstool, supported in one side by what we have learned from medicine, on another corner by what we have drawn from religion. And the other leg, of course, is our own experience of drinking and recovery, a synthetic concept that has made all this possible. So to all of our friends of medicine and religion who are present, we gratefully acknowledge our debt. And perchance, there are some of the men and women of the press here who have been couriers over the past years of our message to all the world. And never a syllable of ridicule or criticism have these ever written of Alcoholics Anonymous. Their work has made possible the recovery of tens of thousands of afflicted ones. So to them, our deep thanks. And we think of the host of other friends we've had, the goodwill of the citizens of this town, of those in government, of those in many places, whose goodwill means so much to us. What a fine expression that just was, that four of the citizens should come in here to make us know that we are now respectable ones, to make us feel needed and wanted in this community. In fact, is it not a rather singular circumstance that a gentleman from the sheriff's office should be singing to a bunch of drunks? Have you ever thought of that? And speaking of my own special reason for gratitude, I find no words to describe my feeling about what has happened here as I bring you congratulations from AAs all over the earth. For today, the sun never sets upon the Society of Alcoholics Anonymous. And these send you their greeting and their brotherhood and their affection. And I thank all who have made this happy event possible. Those whose labors have been unseen, but which have flowered in this wonderful occasion, and the hospitality you have extended to me. Alcoholics Anonymous is now about 16 years old. And yet we sense that we have passed through three periods. A period of infancy, a period of adolescence, and now we think we are upon the threshold of maturity and face our future. We are now taking destiny by the hand. So I think it would serve the purposes of this meeting if I led you through the years of infancy, during which time we develop the principles and apply the principles upon which individual recovery is founded. And then I took you through that exciting period of adolescence, when we lived and worked together, during which time the tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous was generated. That body of principles of group conduct, which we hope may contain us in unity for so long as God shall need us. And I would specially like, then, to emphasize the fact that with us at Alcoholics Anonymous, faith is dead without works. In other words, this is a society of action. Action is the magic word. So I would like to dwell a bit upon the whole idea of service, as we now see it, as it applies to what I hope will be a great and happy future. For some 16 years now, you and I have been watching a great building under construction. To us of Alcoholics Anonymous, this is something more than a building. This, to us, is a veritable cathedral of the Spirit, into which 120,000 of us have now entered, and herein have found peace, and a brotherhood, and a freedom, of which we could never have dreamed in yesteryear. So let me take you back now to the very beginning, leading you down through our infancy and adolescence to where we are now, marking as we go those important realizations and decisions which have so deeply affected our destiny. In a sense, AA has just been a succession of realizations and decisions taken by individuals and groups of individuals. Let us see what some of those were. In the summer of 1934, I lay in a hospital devoted to the care of alcoholics. It was the end of a long road, and for the first time, I understood the futility of my position. I knew that I was utterly hopeless. I knew that I had no power of my own to go on living. And that verdict had been pronounced by science, which had said, the alcoholic is one who has an obsession which condemns him to drink against his will, an increasing physical sensitivity that condemns him in time to go mad or die. And those terrible facts of my case had come home to me in flood time as I lay there on my bed. So, without realizing it, I was having a realization that is absolutely indispensable to each one of us before we may make any progress to recovery. A realization which has been shared by every alcoholic in this room. I had hit bottom and knew it. I was not the only one who shared this realization. Downstairs in the hospital, a famous doctor was talking to Lois, my dear wife. And like many a woman before and since, she was asking these questions. She was saying, "Doctor, for years, Bill has wanted to stop. He has desperately wanted to stop. He has been willing to do anything. Now, Dr. Bill was always a man of great willpower. In other matters, why doesn't his willpower work now? Why can't he stop, Doctor? And, Doctor, how serious is this business?" And the good man was compelled to tell her that my habit of drinking had slowly turned into an obsession, a veritable insanity, which condemned me as much to drink as a kleptomaniac is condemned to steal, and that my physical condition had deteriorated, perhaps my brain already a little, and that that was the age-old dilemma of alcoholism. And like many another woman, Lois said, "Well, what does that mean, Doctor?" Gentleman that he was, he had to tell her, "It means, Mrs. Wilson, that you must soon put him away somewhere, else he will go mad or die." So this realization of hopelessness, now so important to every one of our society and embodied in the very first step of the AA program, came not only to me, but to one very near and dear. How well you women and the husbands of alcoholics know. Leaving the hospital, I was very badly frightened. For a time, great vigilance kept me sober. But little by little, as I felt better, my fear wore away. And in November of that year, the obsession had me. There I was, alone drinking in my kitchen. Lois working in a department store to support me. I no longer dared go in the streets, lest I be taken up by the police. Drinking a fifth of gin to be high per day, two to be tight, and three to be drunk. Drunk most of the time. Continues. Could not stop. Well, at that juncture, a friend I hadn't seen in many years had a realization, and he took a decision. He, too, had been visited by this dire malady. I had known him to be a hopeless one for a long time. Suddenly the telephone rang. Here he was on the other end of the wire. I knew at once he was sober. Had never known him to be in New York City sober. And I said, "Come over, Abby. My friend, I'd love to see you. We'll drink together, and we'll talk about the good old days." Ah, what a significant remark. The good old days, indeed. For you see, to me, the present was unbearable, and there was to be no future. Yes, we drink together, and talk about the good old days. Well, I met him at the door. And by some psychic sense, I saw at once that he had something more than just sobriety. I couldn't make it out. He came in, sat at the kitchen table, I pushed over a full tumbler of gin. He said, no thanks. I said, Evie, what's got into you? You on the water wagon? Oh, no, no, I'm just not drinking. I was puzzled. I was disappointed, too. We visited a little bit. I was very curious. I said, come, my friend, what's got into you? Simply and smilingly, he looked at me and said, I've got religion. I shuddered. I said, now, this poor boy has substituted religious insanity for alcoholic insanity. Too bad. He may as well have hit me in the face with a wet mop, for I was one of those agnostics. I was one whose modern education had told him there is no God. Oh, the poor fellow. Well, one had to be polite. So I said, well, Evie, what kind of religion have you got? Oh, he said, I wouldn't really call it religion. You might call it the religion of common sense. I just picked up some ideas from a group of people. One of them happened to be a drunk like myself. And here they are. Very simple ideas. None of them new. He said, under their advice, I got honest with myself as I had never been before about my personal defects. I quit the accursed business of living alone and confessed my defects to another person in confidence. Gave me a lot of relief. Then I made a survey of my broken relationships and of the damages my drinking had done. And I went to all those concerned to make amends, to ask forgiveness, being careful not to confess their sins in the process. And then these friends had advised me that I ought to learn of a new kind of giving, the kind of giving that demands no reward. And he said, Bill, here is the final point of my simple way of life. I discovered that I could not put these principles into daily operation and make them work on my drinking and on my problem of living unless I asked God for help. Now, said he, I know that's you're an agnostic, may jar you, but that's that. Well, as you see, my friend came with no new idea at all. I'd certainly heard about honesty, and I'd heard about confession and restitution, and that faith without works is dead. I'd even heard about people praying, didn't like the idea. Nothing new. Yet somehow, these simple principles presented by him struck me with tremendous force. Why? And now we uncover another fundamental of AA. One alcoholic was talking to another. I knew that he had been a denizen of that strange world in which I was living. I knew that it was a hopeless world. And I believed it when he said that he had been released from his obsession. That he was just no longer on the waterway. As he put it, it seems as though my obsession had been taken from me. And yet I was revolted at this idea of a God. Well, very wisely, he didn't try to evangelize me. He just said he thought he'd pay me a call, let me know what had happened to him, thereby exercising what our theological friends call the virtue of prudence. A lesson we've had to well learn in AA. And presently he was gone. I continued to drink for the next week or two. But in no waking hour could I get the vision of my friend out of my mind as he sat across the table setting out these simple principles to me. And at length I thought to myself, well, after all, who are beggars to be choosers? You, Bill Wilson, are just like a cancer victim. If you had cancer, you wouldn't expect to cure it yourself. You would depend upon any principle, any surgery, any physician that could check the growth of those terrible cells. And well do you already know that your alcoholism is a cancer of the emotions, a cancer of the mind, and if there be such a thing, a cancer of the soul. So who are you to say there is no God? Who are you to say how you will get well? Just like the cancer patient, you had better be dependent on whatever physician there is who can help you. So I started for the hospital. I thought I'd have the doctor sober me up. I would have to look at this religious idea through completely sober eyes. I mustn't have any emotional conversion nonsense. I presented myself, 293 Central Park West, my old drying out joint. On the way up there, I had got very tight indeed. The drunks here will tell you why. On our way to be cured, for the last time, we always get stiff. May never get another drink, you see. Through the fog, I could see the doctor, and I waved my bottle at him. And I says, "Doctor, at last I've got something." And very sadly, the old man looked at me and said, "My boy, I'm afraid you have got something. You better go upstairs and go to bed." Well, I had come to the hospital early. Delirium tremens wouldn't have caught up with me for another month or two. So in 3 or 4 days' time, I'm free of liquor and any sedative given. But now I'm horribly depressed. I kept thinking about my friend, but again I rebelled about the great physician. Suddenly there he stands in the door. Here it is early in the morning. My first thought was, just as thousands of AAs have since thought, this man practices what he preaches. Then I became a little fearful he'd evangelize. But no, he's prudent. He said, "Bill, I heard you were up here. Thought I'd come up and see how you were." And he made me ask him again, what were the terms of his deliverance? And quite simply he stated them. Well, he said, "Bill, I just got honest with myself. Talked it out with another person in confidence. Cleared away the debris of my past as well as I could. I'm trying to help other people without any demand for reward. That's why I'm up here. Helps me as much as it does you." And he said, "I pray to God as I understand it." And that's all he had to say about it. Soon he was gone. And then there fell upon me the greatest realization of my whole life. My depression increased. It seemed that I was in the bottom of an infinite pit. And at last I cried out, saying, "Now, I am willing to do anything." Then, with no hope at all, I exclaimed, "And if there is a God, will he show himself?" Then I was granted one of those sudden, strange experiences. It seemed to me that the whole room lit up with a great light. I was filled with an ecstasy that no man could describe. I suddenly realized that I was free. In the mind's eye, it seemed as though I stood on a mountain. And a great clean wind was blowing. And I knew at once that it was not of air, but of spirit. At length, the ecstasy subsided. Of course, I am still on the bed. But now I lie in a new world. I felt at one with the universe. A great peace stole over me. And I thought to myself, this is what the preachers have promised. This is the God of the preachers. Oh, I lay there a long time in this wonderful state. Then my modern education got a hold of me. I began to be frightened. I panicked. I said, oh, this must be hallucination. Can this be real? I'd better call the doctor. Have him examine me. He's a good alienist. So in he came. And at this moment, the destiny of our society hung by a very slender thread indeed. I told him what had happened as best I could. Most doctors would have said, oh, well, Bill, just a little hallucinosis, soon pass off. But no, this skeptical man of science, being a great human being, listened sympathetically, asked me a lot of questions. And finally he said, no, my boy, he said, you're not crazy. He said, there has been some great psychic upheaval in you. Somehow you are different. I can't put my finger on it. Maybe you've had one of those conversion experiences that once in a blue moon sobers up alcohol. But I think you have something, my boy. And whatever it is, you'd best hang on to it. It's so much better than what had you only 1 hour ago. So I've been hanging on ever since. There has been no relapse since that day. And so have a lot of other people. Now, you friends who come in here may say, do all of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous have an experience like this? And my answer is, yes, they do. They all have an experience that enables them to do that which they couldn't do before. In most cases, it comes on very, very slowly. What happened to me in 6 minutes happens to them in 6 weeks, or 6 months, or even a year. But eventually, all of us become conscious of the presence of a greater power, who can do for us what we cannot do alone. So that is a common, central realization. Well, such a realization, of course, called for decision. And I made the same decision that thousands of AAs have since made. The decision was, I wanted to help other alcoholics find this release. This release which had come on these very simple terms, yet with such mysterious power. So I began working with alcoholics, frantically, in the missions. This doctor at risk to his reputation let me come back and work in his hospital. There wasn't any result at all for 6 months. When I told of my sudden experience, the alcoholics would just tap their heads and walk off. Couldn't blame them, couldn't. In fact, the cynical still refer to that experience as Bill Wilson's hot flash. Well, I fear that I had a little sense of divine appointment. I was trying to preach. And we yet lacked another element. So after a season of failure, my doctor, good old Dr. Silkworth, who passed away recently, said, Bill, Shouldn't you emphasize the idea much more in this work that alcoholism is an illness, a fatal, progressive illness? And then it began to dawn upon me that that might open up these drunks to such an experience as I had had, or to some enabling thing that would remove their obsession. In other words, if one drunk projected it upon another, that not only here is the release from alcoholism, but also that it is a fatal progressive disease, an obsession of the mind coupled to an allergy of the body, that message coming from one alcoholic to another might strike him deep and humble him enough so that the grace of God might expel his obsession. So I began to emphasize this idea of illness very much. At that juncture, my wife's relatives had begun to say, well, when is this guy going to go to work? When is he going to quit being a missionary? When's he going to get Lois out of that damn department store? Well, under such goading, I began to go over to Wall Street and sit around in brokerage houses, which made it look like I was employed. Sitting there one day, I fell into conversation with a stranger. Curiously enough, that led to a business deal. You see, my old business friends would have none of them. This business deal took me to Akron, Ohio. I had insinuated myself by accident into the middle of a big proxy fight. Suddenly it looked as though I had a controlling interest in a situation which might have made me president of a little company out there. All elated now, I go out to Akron. I think, well, God is rewarding me for all this good work I've done, although not one single drunk was sober yet. Arrived in Akron, the business deal fell through. The other side put more proxies on the table. My new found friends disappeared in the direction of New York, left me in the Mayflower Hotel with a $10 bill in my pocket. And great waves of self-pity and anger swept over. Suddenly I realized that I was in danger of getting drunk. I began to panic. I began to walk up and down that lobby, looking in the bar room at one end, and at the other end, absentmindedly, at a church directory. Well, as I remarked earlier, I don't know what this AA would have done without friends. So I called up a clergyman. I told him of my need to find another alcoholic to work with. I told him that I needed another alcoholic as much as that alcoholic could need me. Well, the clergyman was a little nonplussed. His experience had been that one alcoholic at a time was enough. Why bring two of them together? Anyhow, he gave me a list of people I might inquire among in my search for an alcoholic. I began to call them on the telephone. They'd all see me in church Sunday, or they were going away for the weekend. But my need was urgent. But none were prepared to fill it, excepting the very last one on the list, a non-alcoholic. I called her. It was a famous name in Akron. I was very reluctant. I explained my need, and she said, yes, I know what you were talking about. I am not an alcoholic. But my life got in an awful jam, one I couldn't get out of. I understand what you mean by spiritual awakening and experience. You come straight out here. So here came a non-alcoholic friend, one who cared enough, one who understood, one who would take time. And I told her my story. Straightway she said, there is a doctor here in this town, used to be on the staff at the city hospital. Wonderful chap. Everything is falling apart. He's lost his post. The bank is about to foreclose his house. His wife is half an invalid from these years of drinking. Dr. Bob S. Should I call them up? I think I will. So my new friend Henrietta goes to the phone, gets hold of dear Ann, Dr. Bob's wife, says that there's a stranger from New York who thinks she has a cure for alcoholism. Well, Ann said, this is very interesting, Henrietta, but Dr. Bob has just come home. It's Mother's Day. He has brought in a potted plant out of deference to me. The potted plant is on the table. But alas, Henrietta, he is so potted that he is on the floor. We can't get air today. Well, not a whit discouraged, my friend Henrietta said, how about tomorrow? Let's all have supper here. So at 5 o'clock the next day, Dr. Bob and Ann entered that house. Henrietta put us off in the library. Dr. Bob said he could stay only 5 minutes. He was very shaky, you see. He needed a drink. We talked for 5 hours. And this time it was on a different basis. Because now I realized that I needed that man as much as he could possibly need me. And right then and there, we of AA think, the spark that was to become Alcoholics Anonymous was struck. For you see, my first friend, who later fell by the wayside, and has not been picked up yet. Ann Smith then said to me, Bill, would you like to come and live with us for a few weeks? You could keep an eye on Dr. Bob, and he could keep an eye on you. Maybe you could revive your business deal. So I went to live with Dr. Bob and Ann in what to many of us is a really hallowed home. Presently, Dr. Bob said, well, Bill, if only in self-protection, don't you think we'd better be doing some work with some drunks? I said, yes. So he called the city hospital, got the receiving ward, spoke with a nurse there he knew, said that a friend was in from New York, thought he had a cure for alcoholism. At this juncture, the good doctor flushed deep red, for the nurse had said to him, well, doctor, why don't you try that on yourself? Well, doctor said, yes, but have you got a prospect down there? That's a part of the process. We want to work on another alcoholic. Said the nurse, we have got a dent. He just come in here, used to be on the city council, well-known lawyer around Akron. He's gone all to pieces. He's been in the city hospital 6 times in the last 4 months. He can't even get out of here and home without getting tight. I'm pretty sure he wants to stop. He's got the DTs right now. He's blacked one of the nurse's eyes. We got him loaded with formaldehyde and strapped down. How would that one do you, doctor? So said Dr. Bob, well, put him in a private room. We'll be down as soon as he clears up. This is the medication you should give him. A little later, Dr. Bob and I saw a sight which tens of thousands of us have since seen. And God willing, hundreds of thousands of us shall still see. It was the sight of the man on the bed. It was the sight of the man on the bed who does not yet know that he can get well. The man on the bed in this case was no optimist. He listened as we told our stories of drinking, of the simple precepts of our recovery, of our release, and of course we bore in on him hard about alcoholism, the fatal illness. At length the man on the bed shook his head and he said, no, it's too late for me. I don't even dare go out of here. Oh yes, you fellas have been through the mill all right, but I guess you're only in the wringer up your knees. With me, it's up to my neck. It's too late. Don't talk to me about religion either. I used to be a deacon in the church. Funny thing, you know, said he. I've still got a kind of a faith in God. But I guess God hasn't got any faith in me. I don't know what the matter is. I can't stop. Well, we said, may we come back tomorrow? Oh, gosh, he said, this is a lonesome business. He said, I'd love to have you come back tomorrow. So on the morrow we came, and the man's wife sat at the foot of his bed. We heard her saying as we entered the room, why, husband, what has got into you? What makes you so different? And seeing us in the door, he pointed and said, yes, they are the ones who understand. And then in happy excitement, he told about the long hours of the night before. And finally the thought had come, well, maybe if they have been granted release from this thing, maybe I can have that gift too. And he began to have hope. And then, as he became entirely willing to follow our simple precepts, he felt a singular sense of release. I'm free. I'm conscious. Which now had swelled into such a great tide that he said to his wife, my dear, fetch me my cloak. We're going to get up and get out of here. So AA number 3 rose from his bed, walked out of that place, never to drink again. And that was in June 1935. Although we realized it not. The first AA group had begun. I stayed on for a few weeks more. The three of us worked with other alcoholics. Mostly failure, but one or two did turn their faces to the light. Returning to New York in the fall of that year, now a little more chastened, a little more experienced, a group took shape there. Then came the must tell what we knew to the million who knew not. How were we to do that? It had taken us nearly 3 years to produce these recoveries. How are we to transmit this message? Could it crawl its snail's pace? We realized that within gunshot of where we sat, people were dying like flies. People said there were 1 million alcoholics in America and 3 or 4 million more in the making. How could we let them know? Well, naturally, we thought in terms of hospitals. Hospitals didn't want drunks. They never paid their bills. They never got well. You couldn't blame the hospital. So we thought, well, our society will have to have a string of hospitals. And then we thought, well, our older members will have to go to other localities to start groups. And surely we should have some kind of a book so that our experience can be put on paper, so that it won't get garbled, so that those million who don't know can at least read about what happened to us. So, that very evening, the Akron group met with Dr. Bob and me, and we took a decision over the objection of some, that I was to go back to New York and raise money so that we might have a chain of hospitals. We might tell our members, older experienced ones, to go to other cities, and so that we might have a book. One day I go to my brother-in-law with an imaginary ulcer attack. I'm grousing how stingy the very rich were when it came to drunks. He said, why don't you talk to Shirley Wynn here in my office, former health commissioner? Shirley gave me a fine reception. He said, yes, said this will need a great deal of money. I can see that. Next thing you know, he says, why not the Rockefeller Foundation? I shook my head. He said, oh, no. He said, the fellow for you to see is John D. Rockefeller personally. Well, I said, Dr. Wynn, I don't wish to be facetious, but could you not also give me an introduction to the Prince of Wales? He might be interested too. No, he said you should see John D. Rockefeller personally. Then here was this thread of destiny. So thin, so tangled. My brother-in-law stands there scratching his head and he said, when I was in high school, I knew a girl and she had an uncle, probably an old man now. I think he's a friend of the Rockefeller family. I don't know that he'll remember me. Shall I call him up? The upshot of that conversation is that very day, my brother and I walked straight into John D. Rockefeller's private offices and were talking to his best friend. Well, that resulted in setting up a foundation in New York called the Alcoholic Foundation. And we were very optimistic that it be filled soon with great riches to do all this good work. Missionaries, hospitals, books. It looked very easy. And these new Rockefeller contacts seemed very interesting. One went to Akron, made a survey of Dr. Bob's situation, came back with a glowing report, thought Mr. Rockefeller should give us $50,000 at once, open a rest home in Akron. We were in a state of tremendous enthusiasm and excitement, excepting the few conservative AAs, who had begun to murmur, well, what all this business? Confuse us? Would we be creating a professional class? But no, I brushed all that aside. The promoter element won out. The report went into Mr. John D. Rockefeller. And then and there, that man took a decision that saved this move. His old friend Dick Richardson had brought him this glowing report about the alcoholic group in Act, the one in New York. And his recommendation for money was plenty to follow. And Mr. John D. Rockefeller Jr. read and reread the report. Finally, he looked up at his friend Dick and said, I am strangely affected by this report. It is a terribly interesting thing. But Dick, said he, aren't you afraid that money will spoil this thing? Isn't this a work of goodwill? One person carrying the message to the other? It's still small, but somehow it has tremendous promise. Dare we spoil it with money, Dick? No, said John D. Jr., I am not going to give any large sum of money to those people. I'm afraid I'll spoil it. Oh, what a blow that was to us alcoholics. Well, we worked on with some of his friends. We convinced him that we should have a little money, at least for a book. We create a foundation called the Alcoholic Foundation. Grandiose idea, it'd be kind of a little brother to that Rockefeller Foundation someday, you know. Nothing happened. We were given the best letter, you can imagine, to people of wealth, and we solicited money all during 1938. And all that summer, we didn't get 1 cent. So finally, the alcoholics in New York began to subscribe and put money in a little common pot so I could go to work on this book today. Gone were our grandiose ideas of strings of hospitals and professional work. And so, after a great struggle, this society in 1939 produced a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. At that moment, our friends began to rally around. There came our friend of religion, Dr. Harry Emerson Fosdick, favorably reviewed the book. Soon comes Father Ed Dowling up here in the Sodality at St. Louis, who said its steps, the word-of-mouth program now enlarged into the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, said, Father Ed, these steps are counterparts of our Ignatian exercises. And he recommended us to the Catholic world. My doctor, at risk to his reputation, had set his endorsement on that book. And then our friends really began to rally around. Came our friends of the press, Liberty Magazine gave us a great piece. And then in 1940, at one of the meetings held in this empty foundation with the friends of Mr. Rockefeller, we had word from Mr. Rockefeller for the first time since 1937. And he said he wanted to give this society a dinner and invite his friends. He invited a great number of wealthy people. We drunks thought our money troubles were surely now over. That room full of bankers could have produced $2 billion, we thought. Dr. Fosdick spoke. Another famous neurologist spoke. The alcoholics had something to say. We thought the great moment was here. When Nelson Rockefeller, representing his father, who was sick that night, got up, and he said, "You know, this thing has deeply affected my father's life. It has engaged his interest as nothing else ever has. But, and gentlemen, my father is delighted that his friends could see the beginning of his great and promising work." But fortunately, continued Nelson Rockefeller, "this is a project that requires no money. It is a work of goodwill." And with that, $2 billion worth of bankers got up and walked right out the door. In the next year, a great decision was taken by the owner of a great American periodical. An editorial meeting was being held, probably in January 1941. An editorial meeting was being held by the Saturday Post people. They were considering whether they would print a piece about it. Most of the editors were against it. Thought it would get us into trouble with medicine and religion. Might turn out to be a cult. The owner of that magazine was present, Mr. Box. And he said, "Gentlemen, I don't wish to influence your policy over much, but this time let me urge it on you. I myself have seen two of these miracles. I am deeply convinced there is something wonderful. I do wish you'd publish that piece." Well, the Post did. Jack Alexander wrote the feature article for the March 1941 issue. And then a little office we had in New York was flooded by thousands upon thousands of frantic inquiries from alcoholics, their wives, their friends, their employers, their clergymen, their doctors. That gave us lists of people in cities all over North America who we knew to be suffering. We mailed them our pamphlet. We drew attention to the book. From our established little groups, we directed travelers to them. And AA began to mushroom, began its phenomenal spread. It had taken 4 years to sober up 100 drunks and produce that book. That was 1939. By 1940, we had 800 members. By 1941, 2,000 members. Then comes the Post article, and we suddenly jump to 10,000 members in 1 year. The word going from alcoholic to alcoholic. One alcoholic talking to another. The press of the world saying, "People, this is good." So Alcoholics Anonymous completed its time of infancy. It was proved beyond any doubt that practically any alcoholic in his right mind who wished to get well badly enough would do so. The formula for recovery was now above ground and had begun to come into plain sight of the alcoholics of the world. As we entered this exciting, fearsome period of adolescence, we were beset with another terrific problem. You see, when the alcoholic is sobered up, he is by no means made into a saint overnight. he is still a very erratic person. So, these newly forming groups, some of them formed just by mail, we call them mail order groups in those days, began to write in about the terrible troubles they were having. Quarrels about money, quarrels about prestige, quarrels about clubhouses, panhandlers panhandling. Then the alcoholic ladies had begun to show up, and it was darkly supposed that we would be full of Little Red Riding Hoods and Big Bad Wolves. That might disintegrate. People began to come out of the asylums, and the conservative AA said, we can't mix this with lunacy. And people began to come out of the prison, and we began to have all sorts of organizational trouble. In other words, the forces that tend to divide all society, having to do with prestige, with property, with authority, with sex, those forces which tend to rend all societies apart began to beat upon us with a terrible power, neurotic people that we were. Now then, if the 12 steps would hold the individual in one piece and release him from his obsession, would the spirit of those 12 steps applied to our problem of living and working together hold us together as groups, and could we function? That was the great conundrum of the period of adolescence. Could this movement go on living and functioning as a movement? That was important. Well, on those thousands of anvils of experience was beat out the tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous, now stated in 12 points, like the steps themselves. And the tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous, to strangers to our society, has many very singular features. Most societies of men say you may come in here under certain conditions. You pay so much. You agree to so-and-so. You sign something. Well, in the early days of AA, because we feared all sorts of strange people who might disrupt us, we had all sorts of membership rules. We talked about the pure alcohol, the alcoholism without any complications. Of course, we get a big laugh out of that now, but we tried to, in our fear, to have a very exclusive class of people. There are even some who said they ought to come on the right side of the tracks, who, you know, all of those things. Today, all of that has changed. We now know that we can safely and gladly open our arms to the whole world and say to any alcoholic man and woman, we do not care who you are. We do not care what you've done. You can become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous if you say so, and we cannot keep you away. Oh, we old-timers shudder at membership rules we once had, which might have kept away some of our most beloved people. No, we of AA have found that the door of the court of last resort can never be closed to our brothers and sisters anywhere in the world, no matter who they are. Well, as time went on, we began to develop curious ideas about money. As a matter of fact, this decision by Mr. Rockefeller, strange as it was, had saved this society from a professional class and a property class. So, more experience confirmed how right he was. Today, for example, we say to the whole world, once you sober up alcoholics, they can well earn their own living. Yes, in fact, perhaps the average earning power of this society is twice as great as the average for America as a whole. It is probably true that our fellowship of 120,000 people will earn in personal income in the next 12 months, $600 or $700 million. Just found money. Well, realizing that, we now say, why, of course, we have something to give society. So we never solicit money. We decline outside contributions. Our foundation in New York recently declined a foundation of $10,000 from a well-meaning person who had left that sum in her will. When news of that leaked out, our clipping services showed that periodicals and papers all over the world commented on this strange society of alcoholics. People who had always said, we have no troubles that money can't cure. And here was this strange society of Alcoholics Anonymous declining $10,000. Who ever heard of such a thing in this modern world? Then we had a great struggle about this question of professionalism. In the early days, we felt we would have to have older members subsidized somehow to carry this message. But now we know that there can be no such thing as professionalizing Alcoholics Anonymous. And from the very top to the very bottom of our society, nobody is paid by AA members to carry this message to another alcoholic. Not a soul. Why, yes, we have caretakers in our clubhouses. We pay them for being janitors. We have secretaries in our offices, the few we have. Little information center. We pay them for being secretary. Am I paid by this movement? No, not a cent. I once authored the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, the text of it. For being the author of that book, I'm paid a royalty. So I can say to these drunks, every time you buy this book, drunks, I've got you for 50 cents a piece. And that is my sole income from this work, which I earned as an author, but not as a therapist or as a missionary. We have no professional work. Well, and there was this question of whether AA was to have a governor. Most societies have to have some head or tail, somebody in authority. Well, it was very discouraging and disturbing for me to learn in the early years of AA that drunks simply will not be governed. That is, not by other drunks. So today in AA, there is not one soul who has any personal authority over another alcoholic. We have some little service committees to do some chores. We may keep an office open in a large city so they can answer its mail and telephone. We have some trustees who issue some books and pamphlets, look after public relations, all that sort of thing. But not one of those people can or ever will have the slightest authority over this movement. Just an authorization to serve, but never to govern. And each group of Alcoholics Anonymous may call itself an AA group so long as two or three alcoholics are gathered together for support. Even if they differ with the whole program, provided, of course, their behavior doesn't affect our society as a whole. Strange society, this is. Now in America, we have a wonderful tradition. You and I love it, every bit of it. But in some respects, the Society of Alcoholics Anonymous is flying directly in the face of American tradition. Here in America, we love heroes. We are hero worshipers. Business is transacted on big names and big people. News is made on big people or big villains. Everything is done on the basis of personalities at the public level. We found that that tradition was, for our purpose, far too unsafe. Moreover, we finally sensed that it might be a refreshing thing in this country if its citizens found among themselves a society whose members wish to have no personal prestige at the public level. A society willing to place principles before personalities. We thought that might be a refreshing thing. And it was. And as a result of it, every newspaper reporter who visits an AA meeting sees at once that nobody has any personal angle here. Nobody can profit personally. So he becomes a convert to our ideas. He writes wonderful publicity. AA has had millions of dollars of free publicity due to the fact, largely I think, that we do, at the public level, place principles ahead of personality. Then, too, that anonymity guards the person coming in. The skeleton isn't going to walk in the streets. We have found, too, that it is of immense protective value to this movement. At one time, we supposed that Alcoholics Anonymous ought to educate, ought to research, ought to try to do everything for the alcohol problem that there was to be done. But in late years, we have found that this society must needs confine itself to one single purpose, carrying that message to the alcoholic, face to face. And that's all. As individuals, yes, we can cooperate with outside enterprises, but we must not transfer the AA name to them. Oh, we're very much changed in that. And then we found, too, this anonymity has a deep spiritual significance. It is a token of our group and personal humility. I recall the time when we were trying to find a title for the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't a very popular title at first. And as we groups voted upon it and the other titles, it gradually rose in popularity. At first, I was very much for this name. And then there came to me a temptation. I thought to myself, suppose this book, when it is published, becomes an important adjunct to a movement. Why should that book be called Alcoholics Anonymous? Why shouldn't I sign that book? Why shouldn't we call it The Way Out by Bill Wilson, huh? Alcoholics Anonymous. I got so I didn't care too much for that. And then I thought to myself, well, in the outside world, practically all authors sign their books. The laborer is worthy of his hire. I think I should sign this book, having contributed so importantly to its preparation. And when I made this proposal to the little groups of that day, their eyes took on a look which I now quickly recognized. And the group conscience began speaking to me, and the group conscience said, Bill, you can't do this to us. You can't do this to us. That would make you a public figure. You might fall on your face. You might get swelled head. You might let us down. Those things could happen, couldn't they? Moreover, you set an example for every drunk who follows you to do the same thing. Isn't that what blew up the Washingtonian Society 100 years ago? Oh, yes, it's all right. All other authors do it. But, Bill, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. This is something different. AA works not because it is precisely like other societies. It works because it is different. No, said the group conscience to me, you can't do this to us. Aren't you the fellow who has sometimes said in these meetings that sometimes the good can be the enemy of the best? AA must have the best, for this is a quest for survival. So Alcoholics Anonymous it was. Years later, I sat in a projection room. March of Time had made a picture about AA. The vice president told me, this is to be shown to 12 million people. And as that picture unrolled, here was the book Alcoholics Anonymous, held up to public view two or three times, to the view of 12 million people who would see that picture. And across its face it said, Alcoholics Anonymous, period. And I thought to myself, if that thing had been called the Bill Wilson Movement or the Way Out by Bill Wilson, would the march of time have been showing that to 12 million people? No. We might not even be alive as a society. Thank God that I obeyed the group conscience. So at long last, I found out that I was no longer a teacher of this society. I was its pupil. And our adolescence closed with the confirmation of these traditional principles at Cleveland, Ohio, in 1950. When some 7,000 of us gathered together, reviewed our 12 points of tradition, now stated definitely, and came to the conclusion that Alcoholics Anonymous was willing to commit its future to these principles, asking God that they keep us in unity for so long as he might need. That was done at Cleveland last summer. And at that very moment, I think, AA stood on the threshold of its maturity. AA took its destiny by the hand. Now, during all this time, there was one other factor at work about which nothing has been said. How could AA best function? You see, those early meetings were just drunks and parlors. There weren't any dues, there weren't any fees. Well, there aren't any today, to be sure. But no money was needed. It was utterly simple. There weren't any committees, there weren't any founders. But even then, our wives were brewing coffee and making cakes for those fellows feeling their way toward the light out front there. They performed a service that helped AA function. Then we moved into halls. Well, you had to have somebody pass the hat. Pretty soon you had to have a secretary to write a letter. A chairman to see the local newspaper, radio station, doctor, clergyman, or whatnot. Not people to govern that group. Just people to do some chores so it could function. And so, the same situation grew up in large metropolitan areas. No one group or individual could assume to represent all AA in that area. Hundreds of people wished to reach us. They had to be able to get us on the phone. We had to make arrangements for affairs such as this. Chores had to be done so the area could function. We had to get rightly related to the hospital, to the people in the community. It's a public relations job, locally. So we have little service offices in our life.
Please turn your tape. Do not rewind. Turn your tape and continue on side two.
So we have little service offices in our large cities. They don't cost much. Hire one or two people. But those services are vitally needed so that this society can function. Not a government, just a service that helps AA to function. So that my mission of late has been to bring this whole idea of service into its proper focus. And these services especially. Now you remember way back there in 1938, we organized this foundation at the center, which never got any money in it from the outside, except some very small contributions that allowed Dr. Bob and I $30 a week for 5 years. That's all the money this society ever had from the outside. The alcoholics who clubbed together to produce this book transferred their ownership of it to the foundation. So that our book is now owned by AA. Then when all those inquiries came in as a result of the Saturday Post piece, tens of thousands of us, AAs all over the country chipped in $1 a head a year to keep an office open in New York to answer those and to refer them to help. And then came a public relations problem. And then we had the question of relating ourselves to top-flight medical people, to clergymen, and all of that sort of thing. Then there was this question of the loner at sea. All sorts of problems arose which had to be handled at some set point. Now I have invested about 12 years of my life in helping to supply those services which now cluster around our foundation in New York. So we are today seeing AA as three inheritances or legacies. The legacy of the 12 steps that enables the individual to recover. The legacy of the 12 traditions which we trust will contain us in unity. And the legacy of service, which will enable this society to function down the years to come. And just before he passed away, Dr. Bob and I joined in the preparation of a little tract here called Our Third Legacy. Will you accept it? That is the legacy of service in general and of those headquarters services in New York, which we hope will help AA function. And I will just read you in conclusion a couple of paragraphs and then your legacy of service. Here it is. This first paragraph deals with a bunch of suppositions. Supposing all these years we hadn't had these services. Suppose that no one had looked after these chores. That reads as follows. Suppose then all these years we had been without these services. Where would we be today minus the AA book and our standard literature, which now pours out of headquarters at the rate of, presently, 8 tons a month? Supposing our public relations had been left to thoughtless change. Suppose no one had been assigned to encourage good publicity and discourage the bad. Incidentally, Fortune magazine carried a feature article on Alcoholics Anonymous last February. I suppose most of our members read that and said, well, that's very good. They wouldn't know that their headquarters had spent many, many hours with the editors of Fortune and the fellow who wrote that piece so that it could carry our message well and truly. Now, supposing no accurate information about AA had been available, imagine our vital and delicate relations with medicine and religion left at potluck. Then, too, where would thousands of AAs be today if the central office hadn't answered their frantic letters and referred them to help? In what shape would hundreds of distant groups now be if that office hadn't started them by mail or directed travelers to them? How could we have managed without a group directory? What about those foreign groups in 28 countries clamoring for translations, proved experience, and encouragement? Would we now be publishing the book at Oslo, Norway, in London, England? What of those lone members on high seas or in far corners of the earth? Those prisoners, those asylum inmates, those veterans in service or in hospital? Where might we be one day if we never had the grapevine, our mirror of AA life and principal form of written expression? How grateful we are for those secretaries, editors, and friendly trustees who have stood sentinel all these years over our principal affairs. Without all of those things, where would we be? You must have guessed it. We'd be nowhere, that's sure. So it is that by the steps we have recovered, by the traditions we have unified, and by our headquarters services we have been able to function as a society. Now, last April witnessed a truly historic event. Quite as important in its bearing as that summer day last year in which we confirmed the tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous. Representatives of the AA movement from the states and provinces of North America met in New York to assume charge of our principal services. It meant that control of these things were passing from us who are older in AA to you who are younger.
Good.
The conference assembled and did accept its legacy of service, which, in conclusion, I will read to you as Dr. Bob and I wrote it last fall. We, who are the older members of AA, bequeath to you who are younger these three legacies: the 12 steps of recovery, the 12 traditions, and now the general services of Alcoholics Anonymous. Two of these legacies have long been in your keeping. By the 12 steps we have recovered. By the traditions we are achieving a fine unity. Being someday perishable, Dr. Bob and I now wish to deliver to the members of AA their third legacy. Since 1938, we and our friends have held it in trust. This legacy is the general headquarters of AA, the foundation, the AA book, the grapevine, the general office. These are the principal services which have enabled our society to function and to grow. Acting on behalf of all, Dr. Bob and I ask that you, the members of AA, now assume guidance of these services and guard them well. The future growth, indeed the very survival of Alcoholics Anonymous, may one day depend on how prudently these arms of service are administered in the years to come. So now, my friends, I think that you see that the outline of our cathedral of spirit is taking its final form. On the great floor of that cathedral, we see inscribed our 12 steps of recovery. You and I have seen its side walls rise and know that they are now firmly buttressed by the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, which shall contain us in unity for so long as God may need it. And now I am sure that you apprehend that the spire of our cathedral is being set in place. And you know that the name of that spire is service, a beacon to all those brothers who do not yet know. And may the symbolic finger of that spire of service ever point straight upward toward God.